Okay, well, thanks, Janet, for inviting me to give a talk. I want to talk about the topic of Lifshitz solutions in string theory, and it's based on three different papers that I've written over the last 18 months. And at the bottom here are a list of collaborators. Luke Barclay's just finished his PhD at Durham. Harry Bravner did a master's at Durham, and then some of the others may be a bit more familiar, Susha Paramesaran, Simon Ross, Gianmassimo Tassonato, and Yvonne Zavala. So a brief outline of the talk is that this is going to be very much a geometry type of talk. It's going to be talking about space-times, and I'll start by just reminding us all of what Lifshitz space-times are, and what you need in order to produce them. Then I'll get to the main sort of body of the talk in terms of the work that we've done, and I'll discuss how to embed these Lifshitz spaces in a very general sense into models which you could say, I've said into string theory, but of course what I actually mean is embedding them in, as a supergravity solution, which is derived from some sort of string theory, either 2A, massive 2A supergravity, or 2B. So then I'm going to focus in on one of those examples to go into it in detail, and I'll try and give a sort of panorama of the different types of solutions that you can get. So I'm going to talk a little bit about flows between different Lifshitz and ADS solutions of the supergravity, and about black hole solutions, which is the most recent paper, and discuss some thermodynamics, and then wrap up, hopefully, on time. Okay, so just a very brief bit of background. By its nature, so there's a lot of work in string theory on the ADS-CFT, or gauge gravity correspondence, but of course, by its very nature, it concerns scale-invariant systems. And if there's this whole sort of new branch of string theory trying to apply this gauge gravity correspondence to condensed matter. And if we want to be a bit more generic, or in other words, if you actually want to convince the condensed matter theorists that you've got something useful to say, then you've got to be able to go beyond this pure scale invariant theory. And a very simple step beyond scale invariance is this dynamical Lifshitz scaling. And the basic idea is that if you rescale your spatial directions by a particular constant, then your time rescales by a power of that constant. So the power z is known as the dynamical exponent. So that's really what a Lifshitz scaling is. It's breaking this sort of space and time invariance. And instead, but only a little, it's saying that there is a sort of simple power law relation between the time and spatial scaling. And so the questions that I'm going to explore here are just showing you how you get this general type of scaling in a string model, and also telling you about black holes. So to draw pictures, I always like to draw pictures, given this anisotropy between the space and time rescalings, you've got to mirror that in your bulk space-time. So I've written here the full space-time in Poincaré-style coordinates. And so this rho is simply a sort of proper distance across into the bulk. And you can see, I've kind of done it so that you can see that when you put z equals 1, you get a simple anti-de Sitter space. And so what's happening as you're moving out away from the boundary into the bulk is your sort of time direction is being squeezed down relative to the spatial directions. So that's kind of the picture with the anisotropy. So this requires background matter. If you calculate the Ricci tensor, you see that, unsurprisingly, you've broken the sort of ADS scaling, which would be TT equals XX is rho rho. And so each of these in general are different, but they're well-defined polynomials or expressions in terms of that scaling parameter z. So that's the basic Lifshitz spacetime, and that's what you want, hopefully, to produce. So the first models were as what is known as bottom up. Obviously, I'm sort of getting towards the drinks afterwards a bit too soon here, aren't I? So there's a really nice empirical model put forward by Katsu, Liu, and Mulligan, which has a matter content, which is sort of coupled one and two form gauge fields, so they're coupled via a Chern-Simons term. But it's known that this you can make this dual to, or it's equivalent to, a massive vector theory. So this is, if you like, the simplest incarnation of a Lifshitz space. The scaling is supported by this massive vector having a particular flux or a charge, and it has very specific values for the cosmological constant relating to the mass of the vector and the charge that the vector carries. So you can sort of see that here the gauge field is got this r to the z. So this is not, as you would expect in any sense, asymptotically either flat or ADS or whatever. It can't be, because you've got this anisotropic scaling all the way out to infinity. So this is the explicit expression of the cosmological constant and the mass in terms of z. And again, this is also dimension dependent, which is not surprising. Usually the cosmological constant is. So there's a lot of work done on these empirical models, including by several people in this room. And they're very useful because they're much simpler than what I'm going to show you in a few minutes. And you can explore all sorts of, or test all sorts of ideas within this somewhat simpler setting. So, for example, constructing black holes is easier. People have managed by sort of adding in a few extra fields to construct analytic black holes. You can explore this idea of holographic superconductivity. Again, if you can just by adding a few extra fields to these empirical models. But they also have problems, and I'm just going to put my caveat out here in front, because I'm not going to be able to say that we've necessarily solved all of these problems. But the Lifshitz scaling is problematic. So, you know, as r goes to zero, I had this picture of the time direction sort of being squeezed. And so that does look like a very worrying thing to actually do. And so, you know, there are sort of arguments that as you go to r equals zero, perhaps the space is actually singular or has some form of sickness. However, of course, what you want to do is to find a string theoretic embedding of these Lifshitz models so that you can actually explore whether there's true singularities, whether they're somehow resolved, whether you're driven towards perhaps some higher curvature regime or strong coupling, or whatever. So that's kind of our motivation for embedding generic Lifshitz in string theory. So, a lot of people were trying to do this, and it seems that, you know, in this very simple context, although you've got massive vectors, Chern-Simons couplings, two forms, one forms, et cetera, these are not exactly strange fields to have in a string supergravity context. The precise couplings, remember that was very, the mass of the vector and the cosmological constant were all very tied to the dynamical scaling parameter. And it seemed that the first attempts completely failed to find a simple embedding of that in string theory. However, in time, various explicit examples were found, usually with a very specific value of z. So, I don't know, I guess, for example, there were some z equals 2 examples found by Donison Gauntlet, who used particular reductions on Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. So, what we did was actually find a general embedding of a general Z Lifshitz space-time into supergravity. There's a six-dimensional 2A or a five-dimensional 2B, And basically, what the key feature that you're looking for is this anisotropic matter source. You want something that has a strong asymptotic presence. So again, you want your Chern-Simons coupling to help you with that. And you're going to have to compactify. So if you're sort of dealing with your string motivator spacetimes, if you're just doing standard 2A or 2B in 10 dimensions, you're going to compactify in such a way as to sort of keep the structure that you want. So what I'll focus on, just to show you how you can do this, is the 2A six-dimensional Roman's theory, which has a dilaton. It's got massive two form. It's got a non-abelian gauge field. Kind of reduced it down here to the essence that we actually need. There's also an additional gauge field. And this is obtained as a sort of reduction of 10-dimensional massive supergravity on a four-sphere. So it is a reduction of a standard 10-dimensional supergravity. But I'll stick with the six-dimensional picture here. So our Chern-Simons term in six dimensions is sort of, it's a little more complicated than the original empirical model. But we've got this M is the mass of the two-form B. This F here is this non-abelian gauge field I was referring to. And the three-form H is, sorry, this two-form here, H, is a combination of an F, which is the other gauge field, the abelian gauge field, and the two-form B. You've also got a slightly complicated potential for the dilaton. So there's no cosmological constant in this. So in one way, we're moving away from this idea of having very specific values for the constants of your theory. So lambda is normally a parameter in your theory. If lambda is fixed by Z in the dimensionality, then you're going to be very constrained. So this steps back from that because it's saying you can still get something that's analogous to a cosmological constant with a potential, but because it's now a potential, it has a little bit more freedom. It's dependent on whatever value phi sits at. Where are we? Yes.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I know as soon as I said H, I automatically said three form, and then I thought, no, it's not. Sorry, yeah. G is the B. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
And that's why the assignment looks problem looks naively bad is secretly okay.
Is what?
The sign in front of the first two, the H squared and F
squared. Oh, be careful because it's probably my signature.
Okay.
Plus
well,
it's
different from the others, but maybe that's because it's PB.
It's possible it's a typo, though.
Okay.
I don't guarantee every single sign that I put in the presentation. I thought it was right, actually. But anyway. Okay, so a picture of the solution. So the way you construct the solution is by taking two of the six dimensions and making them hyperbolic and having a sort of flux compactification of the six-dimensional Romans down to four dimensions. So it's kind of, I don't know, if you know the Salam-Sezgin model, it's kind of like that, but you've sort of flipped it on its head because now you've got a hyperbolic internal space. So you thread that with a magnetic flux in one of the components of your non-abelian three form so that you maintain the Chern-Simons or the effect of Chern-Simons term once you go down to four dimensions. So this is kind of, again, this anisotropic structure as you move through the bulk of the time part squeezing down faster than the space part. And then you have an electric component of this same F3 in the four-dimensional space, which is pointing outwards. So that's analogous to the massive vector solution of the original empirical model. So the full space-time is your sort of four-dimensional Lifshitz across this two-dimensional hyperboloid, and the degrees of freedom you've got in your solution, in principle, are the size of the internal hyperboloid, a sort of length scale in front of the whole four-dimensional setting. And then, of course, there are the charges. But the electric charge here is, of course, directly related to the two-form charge in exactly similar way to the empirical four-dimensional model where you dualize the one-form and two-form to get a massive vector. So that's kind of this. It's very similar. It's got all the same ingredients. But what is different is...
Yeah. Well, I just had a question. This internal hyperboloid, you say it's compactified?
When we wrote it down, we didn't actually have it compact here. But if you, you know, you could imagine sort of identifying it under some discrete group. It doesn't really alter the equations of motion, but I'll make a comment on it right at the end as to whether, you know, the solution space is as fully general as we think it is. So just in a bit more detail, rather like the original Catron et al. Model had a one form and a two form which were coupled, which was dual to the massive vector. In this case, you see that really the two form field and the non-abelian one form field are completely tied to each other, and there's just a sort of single charge parameter. So our Einstein equations, if we work them out, we see now that we've got this nice anisotropy coming up. We've got our RTT, and then we move to our radial components, and we get a flip in the sign of the first term. We move to the parallel components. The first term is flipped sign, and the last two terms. So we can see how we get our anisotropic scaling. However, because we don't have just lambda and m and the charge, we've got the value of the dilaton, we've got a value of the size of the internal hyperboloid, as well as the charge, sort of as well as this potential, which has a more complicated dependence on the dilaton. So we kind of have a little bit more wiggle room in terms of solving those Einstein equations. So when we plugged in our ansatz, put it into the Einstein equations, we find that, in fact, they just turn out to be algebraic equations, and they could be solved for any value of z. So this is, on the left, is the Lifshitz solution. This is kind of rewritings of the various different parameters, having sort of made, sort of taken values of the length scale parameter and the dilaton just to kind of make the equations look nice. So the Lifshitz, for any value of z, given, say, the g and m of the supergravity, we can find values of the dilaton, values of the charge, values of the length parameter L, and values of the internal manifold size, which correspond to that particular value of z. And generally speaking, there are two solutions because there's a square root in here. So there's actually two branches of Lifshitz solutions. However, one of them, if you kind of look, focus in on this line, this is a Q squared, it's a charge squared, has to be positive. Here we've got a minus 6. So it's telling us that below Z of about 5 or so, this lower sign won't exist. So there's two branches, but not two branches for every value of z. Meanwhile, the other aspect is we can always forget about having a Lifshitz scale and just look for ADS solutions and ask what do we have in terms of our, you know, length scale and dilaton if we just look for an ADS solution. And we find also a one-parameter family of ADS solutions. So overall, the solution space, this is meant to sort of represent the solution space. We've got something which is related to the dilaton and something related to the flux on the internal hyperboloid. And here you sort of see this gray line is the ADS solution. So generically, you've got two solutions for a particular charge. And you've got the two Lifshitz branches. You've got the plus root and the minus root. So the minus root stops, as I said, round about z equals 5. The plus root, however, goes all the way down to z equals 1 and joins the ADS branch. So here, this is simply an expression for, you know, what's being plotted up on both the blue and red branches. So that's a sort of schematic representation of the general solution space. So that was the punchline, if you like, of that first paper, was saying that you could embed general Lifshitz scaling for a general Z into a sensible supergravity model. So just as an example, so what those green lines were just lines along at constant charge. And so, for example, this middle green line here is where this combination, this capital Q, this which is related to the flux on the internal manifold, is about a half. Then you've got two Lifshitz solutions. You've got a Z is about 1.5 and another one of around 10, and two ADS solutions. So that's an example where there are four solutions. If you raise this parameter, you eventually hit the point where you're at the degenerate ADS, and then there's just two Lifshitz solutions. If you lower it, you eventually go beyond this double fixed point, and you have just one Lifshitz and two ADS solutions. So the idea is that these lines here are exact, correspond to exact space times, and if they're like they're fixed points overall in the solution space, in the whole parameter space of looking at radial solutions to the supergravity. But you can also look for general solutions. So you can actually ask, you know, what happens if I just look for a general solution to this this model, this supergravity, but maybe I want it to be asymptotically ADS, so I want to start from ADS and go to perhaps another ADS or a Lifshitz, or start from a Lifshitz and go to an ADS. So that's kind of what I want to move on to next, which is talking about sort of flows and black holes. So if you want to, as I said, that if you look at the if you look at radially symmetric solutions, space-time solutions, then you see your solution space is seven-dimensional. And so the critical points were represented by those lines, and they correspond to ADS or Lifshitz solutions. So if you want to know what happens more generally, if you want to find a black hole solution or some actual flow, then you need to look at perturbations around these exact solutions. So that's basically an analysis of critical points. And so it's reasonably straightforward. You just write your fields in a little expansion, perturbative expansion, around your background solution, and look to see what eigenvalues you've got. In other words, what fall off you've got in terms of powers of R. So this is the plot for the ADS space. So in terms of your eigenvalues always occur in pairs, which are symmetric around this delta is 3/2. I've not shown, there's a delta is -3. I've not shown the zero mode here because that just corresponds to moving you along solution space in ADS. So this is how we find our flows. We first analyze our perturbation operators around ADS. We analyze them around Lifshitz. So here's a plot of the same eigenvalues in the Lifshitz spaces. Again, this is the upper sign, the one that goes all the way down to the ADS fixed point. And the graphs have been deliberately done so that the eigenvalues have the same, or at least continuous with the ADS eigenvalues. And this is the lower sign, which has again been, the style of the plot has been chosen to be consistent with the upper sign. So these sort of give you the spectrum around the particular fixed points, whether they're Lifshitz or ADS. And so you can then use that to try and find flows between different fixed points in your solution space. And so these, at least, you know, from a holographic point of view, will correspond to field theories which have different scaling. So you run, say, from a Lifshitz in the UV to an ADS in the infrared, or vice versa. And so this is an example, which is very of a well-known type of flow, from an ADS to an ADS space. So there's no charge at all here. So again, just to take, I'm going to just show some examples of flows, but to sort of sketch what happens, you've got the ADS solutions here in gray, the two Lifshitz solutions. You find that the blue Lifshitz solution is always a sort of, is always sitting out in the UV. So this solution is never in the infrared. That something always flows to that solution at large R. So that was why I put it in blue. Similarly, this Lifshitz one here is always something that happens in the infrared. This ADS over here, likewise, you flow to in the infrared, whereas this other part branch of the ADS could be either infrared or UV. So the basic idea is that if you started here, you could flow to an ADS solution. You could flow via, past the ADS solution to another ADS solution. Or you could flow from the Lifshitz to another Lifshitz. Or indeed, you could have an ADS to ADS flow, or here, ADS to Lifshitz. So just to show that general picture is possible, you can search for those solutions numerically. This is an example of Lifshitz to Lifshitz. So you can see that the charge kind of, it's different notation classically, but the charge kind of gets larger as you go into the interior, but it's non-zero at both extremes. This is a flow from Lifshitz to ADS. So you can see the charge here dropping down. So here you've got an ADS solution right towards R equals zero, but Lifshitz out near the boundary. You can also go from an ADS down to one of those larger Z Lifshitz solutions. And even you can actually, with a bit of tweaking and fine tuning, it shows up most here in the dilaton, you flow from one Lifshitz to one ADS to the other ADS. So basically all the flows that you might think you can get by looking at the phase diagram, you can find numerically. So those are, again, these are sort of exact space times. They don't have horizons. And the only singularities they have would be the usual Lifshitz one if you have a Lifshitz space time in the infrared.
So have you looked at these, some of these flows, certainly in the original Cauchy et al., had a hidden null curvature singularity due to small fractional powers. Have you looked at for the?
I don't believe these ones. These ones, I think, are regular, but I wouldn't like to be pushed on the stability of them, right? So, in fact, we know, and again, I'll come back to this with the black holes, we actually know that there will be some of the space-times will have some instabilities. So you'll see this when I talk about the black holes. I think these flows are okay. So, here you're looking at things to do with the geometry.
Yeah.
Which are nice and smooth.
Well, okay, so I'm not sure if it'd be obvious in this plot.
It probably is, but yeah.
You can frequently get R to some small fractional powers. You try to deviate away from ADS or Lifshitz, mm-hmm. and this can feed into something that's actually a null curvature singularity.
Deviate away from ADS or Lifshitz, you're meaning even in the context of flowing.
Yeah.
Because, I don't think we're seeing any particular evidence of that. These are numerical results, right?
Sure.
So they're not analytical. But you would think if there was anything sick going on, that numerics would pick it up.
Well, there was a similar story again with the original Cauchy solutions, in which naively looked fine,
mm-hmm.
but then Ayn Rand pointed out, actually, they did have
some
the
problems.
Some of them. There's no universal proof or argument.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I don't know if we yet found a case which doesn't have these issues. Maybe you have.
Well,
but,
we don't. I think.
But we can discuss.
I'm not making a statement about dynamical stability
sure.
here, right?
Yeah,
but just from the point of view of radial flows, I think, you know, that we believe these are okay. You know, and certainly the ones, I mean, the ones I've chosen as representative here, you know, all the metric functions, the dilaton, everything is flowing nice and smoothly. So
yeah, you wouldn't say that, but let me let you go on.
Okay. So that was really just meant that talking about flows was just meant to indicate that, you know, at least insofar as a radial solution is concerned, the system behaves more, you know, more or less as you expect if you just look at the phase space and make some quick guesses about what might happen. Now, if you want to look for black hole solutions, which we did, and this is our most recent paper with Luc Suchet, Jean-Massimo, and Yvonne, what you're doing is quite similar to a flow in that asymptotically out near infinity, you're flowing to an exact Lipschitz solution. But the difference here is you're starting from something you're going to identify as an event horizon. So again, what that means is you go back to this, to the space-time I wrote down, and start tweaking it, just looking for something that looks like a black hole. Means in general, you would expect the size of the hyperboloid to change. You also expect your, I'll call it a Newtonian potential to change. And again, the radial part of the metric. So this is a particular ansatz. It's very particular. It's saying that the area of a sort of unit X1, X2 box is proportional to R squared. So in your fields, you're going to change what was a simple P, which would have been proportional to root Z minus 1 into P of R, so that now your gauge field varies radially, and also the dilaton varies radially. And the idea is that out at infinity, you flow to the Lipschitz solution, so you know the asymptotic values of your functions. Near the horizon, you want GTT to go to zero, linearly preferably, so you simply put sensible horizon boundary conditions, something that looks locally, you know, like it's having a simple zero in both the radial and time part of the metric. So that's what you want to look for a black hole. But typically, before trying to do it numerically, I always want to try and find out how much analytic information I can get for a setup, because it then gives you a little bit more courage, if you like, with the numerics, and gives you a bit more faith in the results that you're actually finding. So we know how to do black holes in ADS, so can we use our ADS intuition to attack the Lipschitz problem? So I'm just going to spend a couple of slides discussing the black holes in the ADS solutions in this particular model. So we know that there's the ADS-Schwarzschild solution that corresponds to a Newtonian potential of 1 minus r plus on r cubed. Don't forget we're in ADS, so we'd be multiplying that by r squared. This is a planar black hole. And if we look at linearizing our equations of motion, we can also explore how to charge up our black hole. Can we easily charge it up with a gauge field or with a scalar? So in this case, we find, for example, if we look at a scalar equation, our dilaton and the internal breathing mode of the hyperboloid are coupled. And so the sort of general perturbation equation is slightly messy, but it's actually quite easy to unravel it and to find a general solution for a scalar charge black hole in a sort of probe limit. So here this is saying that there's no back reaction to scalar on the geometry, and it's given in terms of hypergeometric functions. So this would be an analytical profile. It's actually a combination of the dilaton and breather. So I've just put down here a comparison with numerical solutions that have been obtained by integrating out the ADS, the asymptotically ADS space-time. So you can sort of see that the profile here, there are some
sort of similarities between the numerical and the analytical result. And in fact, if you look at for sort of small charges, to the naked eye, the two look the same. I just want to kind of draw your attention to the fact that, first of all, the profiles of the functions, the T and R potentials, have not changed very much. They're all very close. But also, they're all extremely similar to the Schwarzschild potential. I don't know if you can hold that thought, but it will come back when I get to the Lifshitz cases. We can also talk about adding gauge charge. Similar argument, the gauge equation decouples at linear order. Again, the solutions look like hypergeometric functions, but there's a sort of limit to how far along the ADS solution space we can go with these linearized functions, which is consistent with it being a probe approximation. It doesn't mean there aren't solutions at different parts of the parameter space, it just means they have a strong geometrical back reaction. Here's the analytical profile. Here's a couple of numerical profiles for a sort of small charge and a somewhat more substantial charge. The small charge is solid. You see that the functions, the geometry is essentially in its background value, a bit larger, and now you can see that there's some disparity between the time and radial potentials of the metric. But again, the profile's not that different to the Schwarzschild case. So just to point out where things are on this eigenvector plane, this gray straight line corresponds to the ADS Schwarzschild black hole, because that's got the fall off of 1 and r cubed at infinity. The solid black lines correspond to gauge perturbations of the B field, and then all the others, the dotted lines, correspond to scalar, switching on scalar perturbations. So what happens when you go to the Lifshitz setup? Well, first I want to focus on one branch of the Lifshitz. And actually, what I've done here is I've plotted the ADS and the Lifshitz diagram kind of side by side. So I've sort of rejigged how I'm parameterizing the ADS so that I can squeeze it in and make it. And so you see that these, you know, the scalar and the vector operators kind of are nice and continuous across from the ADS to the Lifshitz side. And the -3 eigenvalue on the ADS side sort of appears to continue down to something which has a fall off of R to the Z plus 2. So you can see that's obviously -3 if Z is 1. So just to try and explain what's happening from left to right in that diagram, you're kind of moving along the ADS branch around this hump on the gray ADS branch, and then you're moving up the blue Lifshitz branch on the right-hand side. So in terms of finding some analytic results, we tried to focus on what was happening around here. So we wanted to try and see if the ADS Schwarzschild solution would somehow find its way through onto the Lifshitz branch. The main difference between the ADS side and the Lifshitz side is this solution corresponds to a pure geometric perturbation. The gauge solution is like a pure, at least the linearized level is just pure gauge. And the scalars, on the other hand, they have a little bit of the geometry mixed in with them. But in terms of these two branches, one's pure geometry, one's pure gauge. On the Lifshitz side, because of the way everything sort of talks to each other, all of the fields are non-zero in the linearized perturbations. So although initially we wanted to identify this gray line with a pure Lifshitz-Schwarzschild black hole, that's simply not the case. So the sort of eigenvector space degenerates at Z equals 1. So what we did was just had a little look near Z equals 1 and focused on those two particular eigenvalue branches and expanded in linear order to z minus 1. So in each case, you see that all of the fields, this is the first branch, which is the z minus z plus 2. This is the second branch, which is this solid black line simply expanded near z equals 1. All of the fields are switched on in both cases. However, notice that the coefficients in front of the phi, the h, and the p, the dilaton, the breather, and the gauge field, are the same on each side. So you can see that, roughly speaking, they're almost going to cancel out if you subtract the two eigensolutions. So that will leave you with a simple geometric solution. So our sort of idea is that this is the what the ADS-Schwarzschild will go into. Here's a plot of that linearized exact solution that I had on the previous slide. GTT and GRR are almost the same. The breathers, very close to one. And the gauge field and the dilaton drops a bit as you go to the horizon, and the gauge field rises a little more substantially. So it's a bit cheeky actually putting this solution for me to plot this. I am being a little bit sort of sleight of hand here, in the sense that it's a linearized solution and it really is more reliable out near infinity. But in terms of trying to get some intuition as to what the black hole might look like, I've simply extrapolated all the way in. And in fact, if I look for a numerical solution, I find by doing something which is similar initial conditions, I've got a profile that looks very close to the original one. So although that was a linearized solution, it actually you can find a numerical solution that looks very similar at this same value. So it was the same small value of z of about 0.09. So what we, given the complexity of the system of equations, we had to do this numerically. So in the end, despite all my tries of getting analytic solutions, caved in and did some numerics. So you simply integrate out from the horizon, and you have two separate two-parameter solution, the value of the gauge and the dilaton at the horizon. You integrate out looking for a regular solution at infinity. So that determines for you the geometry, geometric functions FD and H. So now what I'm going to do is show you some of these solutions and sort of try and highlight a few strange things about them or differences with ADS. So if you're not very careful with your initial conditions, we did kind of the obvious thing. In this top set of plots, we are holding the gauge field at its asymptotic value and varying the dilaton. In the bottom set of plots, holding the scalars or the dilaton to its asymptotic value and varying the gauge field. And what you see is that generically this, so the solid, your sort of solid lines are where nothing happens, the dashed lines are where I've pushed the dilaton up and dotted down. It's basically all the sort of legend of the plot is given by looking at this initial condition here. What you kind of see is that in all cases, this Newtonian potential sort of has this huge peak somewhere near the horizon. And sometimes it can be really, really big. I mean, we've seen peaks where this F sort of goes up to of order 100 or so. But as you approach, sort of in this case, for example, as you're dropping the dilaton down, eventually this GTT potential F comes down and has a sort of extremal type of quality to it. But notice that the GRR potential is now doing something quite peculiar. And in the bottom plot, again, if you drop the gauge field, things get worse in terms of the peak in the Newtonian potential. As you raise it, you start calming down the geometry near the horizon. So you might think in terms of geodesics that this big sort of barrier, it looks like a barrier in terms of the Newtonian potential. It isn't, however, if you actually look at the geodesic equation, because you're multiplying it by r to the z, that actually counterbalances this big, big maximum in F. So from a geodesic point of view, you don't see this as a barrier. It's just like something's falling in, and then maybe it goes a little less rapidly. The force drops relative to what you'd expect, and then it goes up again. So that's the this is sort of one main difference with the ADS black holes. Things are a lot more, a lot more features near the horizon. I was about to say unstable, but at the moment we're not sure whether that's true or not. But when you start seeing lots of wrinkles in your fields, you tend to be a little bit suspicious. So those are some solutions for z equals 2. What happens if you shift z? Well, actually, increasing z calms down these potentials again. Things get a lot more regular as you go to higher z. The other obvious thing that happens at higher z is the fields drop to their asymptotic values much more quickly, which is not surprising because all of the power law fall-offs are dependent on z. So just to sum up the generic features, you've got a sharp peak in this GTT function. On the other hand, the radial metric function is relatively well behaved. My feeling is that this is actually telling us that the area gauge may not be the right thing to use to find the black hole solutions. So what we might be moving towards numerically is some feature where, because you've chosen an area gauge, you're sort of hitting this jam or this barrier. And if instead you chose a different gauge, you might in fact see that in terms of area, the area, first of all, decreasing, possibly even increasing. You might, I don't know, I'm just because we sort of did this with area gauge. It's possible that these things might move to having more exotic features near the horizon. So just in the last few minutes, I just want to say that we've looked at thermodynamics of these black holes. So again, it's something we have to do numerically because we have to find our solution for the black hole. We have to then find the values of the fields and then compute the temperature. So in all of these plots and all of our work, we set R plus is 1. And in these plots, T is really T scaled by an appropriate power of R plus. And what these are meant to illustrate here is this is the anti-de Sitter sets of solutions. So these are data points from anti-de Sitter. And it's showing that this black dot is where there's no scalar charge at all. And this is what you expect from a Ryson and Nordstrom type of solution. You increase the charge, the temperature drops, you get to an extremal limit. So now you start switching on the scalar. So the blue is where phi naught, the value of the scalar on the horizon is the dilaton is 1. You see now that it's qualitative. All of these plots are the same. You increase the gauge charge, the temperature drops. Looks like it's going to an extreme limit. But then as you increase the scalar further, your range of P starts to drop quite dramatically. And this is illustrated in the second plot, where here you've got no charge, no gauge charge on the black hole. But as soon as you put some gauge charge on and then you add scalar charge, you find that the range, the temperatures sort of start to cave in. So your range of scalar drops till eventually you can't actually put any further scalar charge on the black hole, it would seem. Lifshitz is quite similar. This is the sort of equivalent of that plot in terms of varying the scalar charge. It looks very, very similar. The main difference, not surprisingly, is what happens with changing the initial data for the gauge field, because of course P equals 1 at infinity. So you don't expect a sort of symmetry around Z equals 1. As you drop the value of the gauge field on the horizon, the temperature, insofar as we can tell, seems to just increase without limit. So it looks like that's some sort of singular limit, at least if you try to keep R plus equals 1. So it's a slightly different plot, but it's kind of got similar features. You increase P, the temperature drops. You increase phi, first you can go further out with the gauge charge, and then you contract with your range. So that's sort of qualitatively what happens. So what happens if you vary Z? Well, it seems like increasing Z makes everything a bit more extreme. It flows, the temperature flows away from T equals 1. Remember, this is normalized at R plus equals 1. So on the left, we've fixed phi 0 is 1 and just looked at different values of P at Z is 2, 3, and 5. And on the right, we've got three sets of initial data and explored out in Z space. So this is, again, just looking at sort of different values of initial data and different values of the Lifshitz scaling. So you sort of see that as you increase Z, everything seems to sort of move apart. So although the geometries are smoother for higher Z, I think that was that last comment, it seems like the range of charges that you can get sort of is smaller. So these are the sort of summary points about temperature. It seems as if just in general, if we increase the gauge field near the horizon, the temperature decreases. So that looks like you're kind of charging up a black hole. The scalar field has a similar effect to ADS. There's a sort of finite range type effect. It increases and then decreases the temperature. And the only thing to note, we'll just have to comment about extremal limits, is that because we've set R plus equals 1, it looks like we don't get an extremal limit. In fact, by looking at the equations of motion, you can show that they're not consistent with a repeated zero of that GTT F function at R plus equals 1. So as we drop the temperature, the radial part of the metric is becoming increasingly vertical at the horizon. And so one way of kind of making that less extreme is dropping R plus. So we have, you know, this is not something that we can prove, but it looks like that if you want to get to zero temperature, you have to go to zero entropy. So again, that's just something that we seem to be seeing from the numerics. Just a last slide or two on entropy. This is looking at the entropy of a Z equals 2 Lifshitz. So we've got generically, if these lines correspond to the horizon value of the dilaton being no different from its asymptotic value 1, 2, and 3. And so changing, if there's no difference in the asymptotic value, not surprisingly, changing P doesn't change the entropy because, of course, we fixed R plus equals 1. But as soon as we add a scalar, increasing the, the gauge charge seems to decrease the entropy. On the other hand, if we look at varying, I think I've got my things, I'm not sure I've sort of said that quite right. So on the right plot, what we've got here is we've got lines for the gauge field at the horizon being 3/4, 1, 1.5, and 2. And as you come round on these curves, what we're doing is we're increasing the horizon value of the dilaton. And so here, this is sort of obviously a lot more dramatic. The curves come up to a maximum temperature and then curl back round again. And so what you're seeing here is that at the same temperature, you've got, and same horizon size, you've got two solutions, one with more entropy than the other. So how can we explain these qualitative behaviors? Well, the entropy density, you're doing this from an area of the black hole. We fixed R plus equals 1, so the only way the entropy can change is from the size of the internal hyperboloid. The internal hyperboloid is represented by what I've been calling the breather, the H function, and that mixes very strongly with the dilaton. So what we would expect that if we change the dilaton, we're going to see a far more dramatic impact on the entropy of the black hole. So we do expect this stronger response to the scalar initial data. But I'm not sure we did expect to see that curving round. And what that is just sort of saying, you know, what that's more or less shouting out is that these black holes are going to have, and most likely, an instability, probably to shedding some sort of scalar charge, having shedding some scalar field radiation. So just to sum up, more or less on time, amazingly, what I've shown you is how you can embed Lifshitz solutions into stringy supergravities. I've focused on the 2A, but we also showed how to do it for 2B, for our three-dimensional Lifshitz spaces. We think it's probably for any Z, but there is a caveat that maybe if we compactify this hyperboloid, we might end up quantizing our Z in some way. It's also the case, although we had to find these things numerically, we did try very hard to find analytic solutions and analytic, even perturbative analytic flows or analytic black holes. But within the construction that we had of the supergravity, we couldn't find any analytic information other than perturbative and had to find numerical full solutions. So the geometries do seem to be quite extreme of these black holes. We seem to sort of have very strongly distorted geometry near the event horizon, which is a little bit concerning, but it's also true. I showed you that plot, which was based on the linearized solution. It's also true you can find smooth-looking black holes as well. It's just the generic one seems quite strongly distorted. So that's what I've told you, and I think, you know, the obvious next step that we're moving to is actually analyzing stability, not just the stability of the black holes, but also just generically looking for, you know, which of the flows are stable and whether, you know, if you have a generic instability in one of these Lifshitz spacetimes, does it actually simply just move the space towards one of the flows? So I'll stop there. Thanks.
So I have a question about the flows. So if I remember correctly, you were saying that there are some flows that connect 3D solutions.
So yeah.
I was just wondering, in the sense that normally, like, you think a flow is some kind of a domain hole that, say,
yes,
connects the asymptotically large raw distance with a very small radius. But you have three. Where is the third one?
So, you can have them. You can also have multi-domain wall solutions. So if you have, for example, if you were thinking of some field, you know, topological defect where you have three disconnected vacua, you could have a domain wall between two. Sorry?
In this case, what is going to set the scale of this intermediate region where the third solution
This one was really, you know, this was incredibly finely tuned, as you can imagine, to get it to sort of skim past. This isn't the exact, quite, it's just a smidgen off the exact ADS because it's flowing on to the other one. So what sets the scale? I think the ADS spaces are characterized by the value of the dilaton and the length scale. So in each of these cases, L is obviously different. Well, in fact, in all three cases, L will have a different value. So my guess would be that it's the ratio of the relative length scales that's sort of setting you.
What I was wondering is whether it's a very fine-tuned thing to have to the third, or is it?
I think in terms of the solution that I presented here, yes, I would say it is, because generically your solution space will, you know, is kind of, to in order to get something where it goes really close to one, I mean, that, you know, you've had to be extremely explicit about initial conditions. Your generic one will kind of just go and miss, because of course I just put down a simple plot where, you know, where I suppressed all but one dimension, whereas this thing's seven dimensional, and so there's a lot of space for it to miss that first ADS. So yes, it's a very, very special fine-tuned solution.
Would there be any merit in trying to do perturbation theory in Z? Do you start off on regular and switch on a very small Z, and that give you an extra analytic handle?
I don't know. Well, that's what we kind of tried to do, actually, with the black hole.
Because I mean, London saw me.
Yeah.
Did you discuss perturbation?
You know, I don't think you think it would. So this was switching Z from one.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah. This one. So yeah.
So this is near Z. This is only near Z equals one. So this one is a nice expression in terms of Z.
Yeah.
The exact expression of the other eigenvalues in terms of Z is really disgusting.
So we can still use Z minus one as a small parameter.
Yeah, so that's what this is here. So this has expanded the black solution in Z minus one. So you see both of these are linear in Z minus one. So the fall off of this one is 1 over R cubed, and the fall off in this one is just a bit less than 1 over R cubed. So it's not quite as rapid a fall off,
but
very close.
And it should work for all R, should this?
Well, no, not really, because what these are doing, these are perturbing around the exact Lifshitz space.
Yeah.
So it's really only true when it's linearized, and also the solutions are radial flows. As you move along one of these flows, you're moving in R. So again, they become more and more exact as R gets bigger and bigger. So going down to R of order one is slightly cheating, but I think when I put the plot here, the values I chose were rig Z minus one was 0.3. Mu is 10, so that mu, I think, so that overall this thing would be, you know, significant enough that you'd get a zero roundabout R as, I think it was a bit over one, and which I then rescaled to one for the plot, and so it's something where you're kind of trying to push the linearized approximation, but still not too far. But these, if you look at the sort of, I guess, the Bianchi identity and see, you know, does the system close? You see that right near the horizon, it's not quite working. So that's why I said it's a little bit cheeky, but I think, you know, it's fair enough. You've got this linear solution, just follow it in, see what it says. And I think, you know, the fact that then going back and rerunning, you know, using that to guess some initial data to find something very similar, you know, meant that it's actually not perhaps as cheeky as I was thinking it was originally. So.
Your internal space, are you just assuming that that's got a uniform negative curvature metric? Is that the sense in which it doesn't matter too much?
Yeah. And yes, absolutely. So obviously in this case with just radial flows, we've not sort of considered any Kalitzer-Klein style modes on that. And you know, we also believe because of the eigenvalue structure as well that the scalar, you know, looking at scalar perturbations will actually reveal Well, I call them instabilities, but it's not clear that those instabilities are actually going to take you towards anything singular, but it's certainly what it's saying is that some of the solutions, we're sort of aware that some of the flows that we found will not be stable dynamically, but other flows we think are. So it sort of depends on the eigenvalue analysis.
Is there some reason to think that the geometry of the internal space doesn't affect your field content? I mean, zero modes in the internal space.
So you mean of the other fields?
Right.
So one of the things we sort of tried was looking at some... Okay, so we did think about a consistent truncation, mm-hmm. and then in that sense, you can get rid of essentially the zero modes on the internal space. But in terms of a general... So what's your do you think might be a problem?
Oh, I wasn't thinking of anything in particular. Right. Just,
yeah.
Just curious.
Because, I mean, I think in terms of sort of looking at how it's kind of a bit like you know, building blocks, or how can you put things together to make your Lipschitz type of solution. And by having that magnetic flux threading the H2, and wanting something that looks Lipschitz, at least asymptotically, there's not a lot more that you can do with a space. But I'm not saying that we've thought of everything, okay? But we did think of some, you know, what else can we dress it up with? And some of the obvious things that to try didn't work. So maybe there is, but we haven't had sort of found anything.
One quick question. I was wondering if there are any kind of candidate or analog of C functions along floors that somehow increase more connectivity.
Right. okay, honest answer, I don't know, right? So one of the problems that we had with our flows, I guess, was in having to, I'm not sure I saw to the numerics now. Can I? So we didn't actually look for a C function in our flow analysis. But I would guess that if you thought about it, you probably could find one. But it would be probably quite complicated, would be my guess. You know, in terms of what it's composed of. But we didn't. We didn't find
conditions. Play a role.
Maybe. That's not something that we actually thought of. So.
There are not more questions. Let's.